the CMU podcast in association with 7 Digital.
This week, the vinyl revival, EMI sample amnesty, the Beatles and Kanye West. I'm Andy Malt, editor of CMU. CMU's business editor, Chris Cook, is not here, but he's not in Edinburgh. Where are you, Chris?
I'm somewhere in between. I don't know if I'm exactly halfway,
no,
but somewhere between Edinburgh and London. You think I'm closer to London than I am to Edinburgh. Is that your geographical, mathematical opinion?
I think you're closer to Edinburgh still.
I'm not, actually.
Damn it.
The north of England's a lot bigger than, southerners like yourself think.
Yeah. Well, it's still a long way away. I'm not sure it's worth going there.
I am in Cheshire. I am in Holmes Chapel, home of Harry Styles. And I'm having a stop off on my way back to London. Next week, I will be in the studio for the CMU podcast. So I'm guessing that probably means there'll be some terrible sequence of events that means that you won't be able to be there and you'll be phoning in. But hopefully we'll both be there in the same room next week.
Yes, fingers crossed. Now, you mentioned Harry Styles. I believe last week we promised an interview with the bakery where Harry Styles used to work. So I guess we'll just cut that in now.
I think if you go back to last week's CMU podcast, you'll find that you promised an interview for this moment in the podcast, and not myself. So have you been to Mandeville's in Holmes Chapel to do the interview?
Yeah, I do remember telling you yesterday that you should do it. So...
Well, when I arrived in Holmes Chapel on Monday evening, what I found, actually Monday evening, Tuesday evening, whenever, when I arrived in Holmes Chapel, what I discovered is that the Holmes Chapel Parish Council is currently doing a survey of everyone who lives in the town. They call it a village, but it's a town. They're doing a survey of the whole town with lots of questions about what people think. So my assumption was, when I saw that on the kitchen table at my parents' house, well, presumably they've got it covered. In there will be a question, what do the people of Holmes Chapel think Harry Styles should do once One Direction are on hiatus? So I was assuming that was all done, but then I flicked through it this morning and it's all about car parks and play parks. There's not one mention about Harry Styles' post One Direction career. So I think the Holmes Chapel Parish Council have forgotten to fulfil their duty there. So therefore, I didn't make the trip to the local bakers because I assumed the local councillors had it covered. And they didn't. So we are basically starting this edition of the podcast with an all-round failure. But
yeah.
I think what's still to come is going to be so good that by the time we finish, and you're doing that irritating thing at the end where you insist that everybody share this podcast.
Which they should.
Everyone will have forgotten about my failure at the start. So let's see how it goes.
Yeah, well, it's going to have to be very good now because I don't know about the listeners, but I am very disappointed. I'm disappointed not only in the fact that you didn't get the interview, but the weakness of your excuse. But let's just move on.
I'll bring back some Mandeville's cakes and then all will be forgotten next week. You won't even remember.
Oh, yeah, you've still got time to do the interview for next week's podcast. That's right. Well,
no one will remember once you've had the cakes. You'll be so impressed with the cakes. One Direction, you won't remember who they are. Anyway, should we talk about things we're actually here to talk about today?
Yeah, why not? And we'll just look forward to that interview next week. The vinyl revival continues. It's such a revival. There's so much vinyl being sold, and now it's going to be sold in Tesco.
We've not really talked about the vinyl revival on the podcast because I suppose we had that big break, and with the old CMU podcast, that was before the vinyl revival. That was back in the days when people either bought their music on CD or they bought their music as a sort of download. And people didn't buy vinyl discs. And then, of course, in the, however long it was it 2 years that we put the podcast on break?
Yeah.
In those 2 years, everything changed. And now everybody buys all of their music on 12-inch vinyl discs. So
all of it, without fail.
So that's why we've not really talked about the vinyl rival before. The vinyl rival? The vinyl?
I've never vinyl, it see, it's hard that, to say, isn't it?
That is quite a tongue twister. So we've not talked about the vinyl revival before on the podcast, but there were not one but two developments this week, one of which you sort of just said.
Yes, Tesco has noticed that there's quite a high markup on vinyl, and so he's going to test out selling it so that it can destroy the market like it did CDs. And it's going to start with Iron Maiden's new album, which it will sell in its 55 of its Tesco Extra stores, which are the big ones that they have in the middle of nowhere.
In some ways, it's sort of surprising that they're selling the Iron Maiden album at all. I don't know if that tells us something about Iron Maiden's fan base. Perhaps it does. I mean, Iron Maiden will have some aging fans there who perhaps do go shopping in town. I can't believe that many Iron Maiden fans deliberately go to buy music in Tesco, but perhaps they're thinking that there is a part of the Iron Maiden fan base who shop in Tesco, and while they're there, they may already have downloaded the album or bought it on CD, and they'll see, I think it's a triple disc vinyl release, isn't it? They'll see the vinyl on the shelf next to, I don't know, the flower. What do Iron Maiden fans buy in Tesco? Next to the spaghetti hoops, and they'll think, oh, I could have it on vinyl too. And as you say, the one thing that has happened to vinyl, I mean, there has been a vinyl revival in that vinyl sales are what at a 15-year high. And it's not just here in the UK. We're seeing this in a number of countries around the world. And it may well be that ultimately, obviously, CD sales are still in decline. They're not declining quite as fast as they once were, but they are still going down. So sort of those people who always resented the fact that CD took over from vinyl and that sort of the HMVs and Virgin Megastores sort of got rid of vinyl perhaps before music fans were ready and forced the CDs on us all. And there's still that hope that CD will ultimately die. Downloads may well become, you know, a minority thing, and vinyl will survive. But it's always important to remember that when the stat is vinyl sales are up 62% this year, they had a very 56. Low starting point. 56, was that what it was? they have a very low starting point. And I think they're getting close to accounting for 2% of the UK recorded music market. So let's put it into the wider picture. The money earned off radio and public performance is more than that, is sort of 7-8%. Sync is slightly ahead of vinyl, and certainly digital streaming and the good old CD are way, way, way ahead of vinyl. But it is interesting that vinyl sales are increasing. And as you mentioned right at the start of this, one thing that has definitely happened with vinyl in recent years is it has become a premium product. If you put out an album on vinyl, if you have the right fan base, you can wham £5, maybe £10 on it. It's more expensive to press vinyl, so it's not all profit margin, but you can put a sizable markup on there, and sort of core fans of the right sorts of artists, mainly rock artists, whereas obviously it used to be that it was dance music fans who liked vinyl, but sort of rock and indie artists will pay that markup. So perhaps you're right to be cynical and think that that's why Tesco, in their quote, they said it's because they've started selling turntables in these stores, and they want something that people can play on those turntables.
Yeah, their music buyer Michael Mulligan said that they'd started selling turntables in their big stores, so these Tesco Extra stores, and they'd sold quite well, so they thought actually selling something to play on them would be the next logical step. And then said if this trial is a success, they would consider selling more vinyl before the end of the year. So say goodbye to vinyl soon when they undercut everyone else on the market and destroy the margins.
It's interesting when you look at the sort of the vinyl sales figures, and there is now, obviously, they relaunched the vinyl specific chart, didn't they? So you can see what is selling on that format. And that some sort of newer indie and rock bands are selling okay, but a lot of it is Led Zeppelin and Pink Floyd and the sort of the re-releases that are coming through. Oasis did a whole load and some of the Radiohead albums. So in many cases, it is sort of either catalogue or older bands, which perhaps suggests that it's not just the kids who are suddenly adopting vinyl. It is sort of people, I don't know, in their 40s and 50s. Perhaps they've got rid of the kids, they've got more room in their house, so they've set out their turntables again, and now they're starting to buy up vinyl once more. So perhaps it isn't that odd that Tesco are getting into this space. It will be interesting to see, A, if it works, B, if on the back of that they really do start selling a wider selection of vinyl, and C, if your rather gloomy prediction that this could be the death of the vinyl revival comes true. I suppose if Walmart join in America, then that is it.
That's it.
Vinyl
it's over.
Is dead once and for all.
But I mean, you know, like you say, I do think there is a certain amount of sense in it. I mean, I think as everything goes digital, people actually still do want something to show who they are. Like, you know, if the digital trend follows its logical conclusion, you'll go into people's houses and they'll have no books or music about, and that's sort of one of the ways people tell you who they are. And so having a nice triple disc gatefold sleeve vinyl, that's one way of doing it.
And in terms of the artwork potential, I mean, I think core music fans, maybe not mainstream pop music buyers, but sort of core music fans do like, and always did like, the visuals that come with a record, and maybe even sort of the little liner notes that used to come with 12-inch releases. And so in that respect, you know, vinyl 12-inch vinyl is more logical to fulfill that role than the CD, just because it's bigger and it sort of looks nicer on the shelf. And was it John Lewis was selling frames so you could actually put them on the wall?
People put them on the wall.
Show them off as works of art.
I think it's interesting that Tesco said this started with them selling turntables, because actually I think a lot of what started the vinyl revival was people just buying the things to have them. You know, there was quite a large proportion of people who bought vinyl regularly didn't actually own anything to play it on. It's interesting that it's the sale of turntables that's pushing Tesco into actually selling the records rather than the other way around.
And that new interest in actual record players as well as records is the second of our vinyl revival stories this week.
It is, because Panasonic at IFA in Berlin this week unveiled a prototype new turntable under its Technics brand. Technics being kind of one of the most iconic, if not, it's SL1200 and 1210 turntables are probably the most well-known turntables in the world, let's say. But Panasonic kind of withdrew the Technics brand almost completely, except for the turntables, which were still selling in the early 2000s. And then by 2010, stopped selling the turntables at all. But now it's not bringing back the old versions. It's building something new, but it has announced that they are bringing back turntables, having brought back the Technics brand late last year.
Yeah, so as you say, they brought back the Technics brand last year, originally for sort of high-quality audio products. Now they're bringing back the turntables, although again, I mean, these will be high-end, won't they? So you'll have to be pretty committed to playing those records that you've bought to invest in whatever format the new Technics turntables take.
Yeah, these are going to be high-end, probably quite expensive. I doubt you'll be seeing them for sale in Tesco. And actually, the Technics director Michiko Ogawa sort of admitted that they weren't really likely to sell many of these when they go on the market, but said that turntables are a very iconic product for the Technics brand, and it was important to show that kind of the history of the brand in what they were making. But the turntable market is still very small, and that was the reason they stopped making turntables in the first place. But as a brand identifier, to use a horrible marketing term, turntables are important for Technics, and it makes sense to bring them back, even if really they're not going to shift very many of them.
So it's just a cynical brand move that they can sell more speakers by also having the record players doing the rounds. But anyway, some more vinyl revival nonsense this week. Long may it continue, I guess, because if nothing else, it's fun to mock in the CMU Daily.
EMI Production Music is holding a sample amnesty, which sounds like a fun thing to do. EMI Production Music, obviously no longer part of EMI itself, because EMI doesn't exist anymore, but is now owned by Sony ATV, it having been part of EMI's publishing division. But what is production music, Chris?
Yeah, what is production music, and why does it normally sit on the publishing side of the music rights industry rather than the label side, even though ultimately we are talking about recorded music? So production music businesses are usually owned by music publishers, and they generally create libraries of recordings specifically with B2B clients in mind. So they'll produce a whole load of music, and then they'll try and sell it or license it to makers of TV programmes or movies or adverts. So in some ways, production music competes with the more conventional sync market. So when you're producing a TV program, you can either pick, existing records that have been released that people will recognize and try and license those from the labels and the publishers, or you can go to a production music library and just say, what have you got that's ready that people won't have heard it before? Well, they might have heard it on another documentary 2 weeks ago, depends on whether or not you get exclusive rights to the music. But what have you got that would sort of look good or sound good, I suppose, for this bit of my TV program? And then you license it. And I suppose the reason to going the production music route rather than the more conventional sync route is that the general principle with production music is that all the copyrights are covered. So EMI Production Music can give you access to music. You can use it for whatever you want according to the terms of the license and the money you pay them. You don't have to go and do a separate deal with a label or with a publisher or multiple publishers or any collecting societies like you do with traditional sync. So that's sort of where production music sits in. And it does tend to sit with the publishers rather than the labels, which is why EMI Production Music was part of EMI Music Publishing, which, as you say, was bought by a consortium led by Sony ATV and now operates more or less as if it was part of Sony ATV, whereas the EMI labels sit over with Universal. So there are various little imprints within EMI Production Music, which is quite funny. In the press release, when they were announcing this, it was sort of like, oh, and this includes, you know, the well-known production music imprints, KPM and Music House and Dead Good and Selected Sound. And it's sort of like, yeah, I'm sure those names only really mean anything to about 22 people. But...
well, possibly, although if you know about sampling and things, KPM would be something, a name you would probably recognise, because there's a lot of... although, as you say, this is generally aimed at B2B work, the kind of the nature of production music being library music does make it attractive to music makers who want to, you know, sample them. And there's a series of albums released on KPM that have been quite heavily sampled by a lot of people. Some of them... legitimately with licenses, some of them not so legitimately.
Yeah, so I suppose, I say, you tend to think of production music being used predominantly by TV companies or film companies, but these companies do put out music aimed at the market, at the sort of the music production market for sampling. Plus, sometimes producers just go dabbling in production music libraries, nab something that was perhaps a TV theme or was intended for a documentary soundtrack, and think, oh, actually, I'll sample that. So when we talk about sampling, sort of in the hip-hop sense, we tend to think of people going to sort of like get classic Motown records or whatever, or some soul tracks, but people do routinely sample from production music. And as you say, the crucial thing about this story is that is part of EMI Production Music's business. If you are putting together a track and you need a drum beat or a little, I don't know, a little bit of melody, you can go delving in their libraries and try and pull some samples out. But a lot of this content exists out there on the internet. And the suspicion is, I mean, presumably EMI Production Music have done some research on this, and they reckon there's quite a lot of tracks out there using samples from their libraries which never were licensed.
Yeah, and that's where this amnesty comes in. They're going to launch a 6 months window where anyone who's used an uncleared sample from the EMI Production Music catalogue can come forward, and EMI will do a licensing deal with them at current market rates. No questions asked for future use of that sample. But most importantly, they won't then go after the previous use of it. So, I mean, if you sampled a track 20 years ago and you're worried about having to pay lots of back royalties, that's not going to happen in this case.
Because I suppose that probably is the fear, that if you've sampled something way back when, or maybe perhaps through some sort of acquisition as a label, you acquire some stuff or you do a deal with an artist, a producer that gets their back catalogue, there may be some samples in there where you're sort of like, I'm pretty sure that comes from one of the EMI Production Music catalogues. But if we go now and admit that this record has been out there for 20 years earning revenue, then could there be... you know, will they suddenly say, OK, we need payment for the last 20 years? Would they potentially sue us? So then you were sort of in that quandary of, well, do we do the right thing and ensure that we don't have some horrible litigation in the future? Or do we just keep quiet and hope nobody notices? Because sometimes people don't notice, because some of these samples are quite generic and could have come from a number of different sources, and just keep quiet and hope nobody notices. So I suppose it's an interesting approach to say, you can come to us in confidence, no nasty stuff's going to happen with any past what is basically copyright infringement, and let's legitimise everything moving forward. It was interesting in the quote, there was a little few get-outs in the statement that came out from the EMI Production Music about this, basically saying if there's any ongoing negotiations with licensees, this doesn't affect that. So if you're already in talks with EMI Production Music about a sample that wasn't cleared, then you're not suddenly able to walk away from those existing negotiations and take advantage of the amnesty. There was also a line that sort of said, this only applies if you come to us, not if we come to you. Which I my inference of that, I don't think it was exactly what they meant, but sort of my inference of that was, it sort of made it sound like a race of you know, you need to get to us before we get to you, otherwise we'll sue you.
So, well, they're saying there's a 6 month window. Presumably, you know, at the end of that 6 months, the kind of the carrot for coming forward and doing this is them not coming after you in 6 months and saying, well, we gave you an opportunity, and now we're going to hit you even harder.
Yeah, so we're expecting a big sort of pile of lawsuits to land on the, on the table in 6 months' time. But it's an interesting approach, and there's various things they said about their reason for doing it. I think partly it is just to, you know, make everyone remember that EMI Production Music and its various little imprints is there. Also, I think they quite fancy the idea of expanding their relationships with this part of the market, and perhaps there are people who have been secretly using their material for a while and they could get some more sort of formal relationship going. Or there was one line where they just said, you know, obviously they hire artists to create all of this and songwriters and producers to create all this material. And they were sort of saying, some of our creators have created samples that may be in hit records and they've never known about it. So it would be a way for the people who've created all this music that sits in the EMI libraries to know, oh, actually, my drum beat was on that number one record. So yeah. Various different reasons given, both commercial and creative, for doing this. And it's an interesting approach, and I suppose they should be congratulated for it.
Yeah.
I hope it works. And perhaps, you know, obviously most of the big publishers have production music divisions. Perhaps they might look to follow suit.
Yeah, obviously it's, well, as you said, the reason that they can do this is because as a production music label, they own both the recordings and the publishing rights on the music. It would be harder to do it on, you know, just a record label or just a publisher.
Yeah, especially as, I mean, obviously with non-production music songs, often, even if, say, within Universal, the label and the publisher had a stake in a recording and a song together, often songs are co-written and therefore co-owned. So on the publishing side, usually you have to do 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 different deals. So yeah, because it's production music, all the rights sit in one pot. It is much easier to sort of make this offer, do the deal, and then hopefully make money moving forward. But an interesting development anyway. So CMU Approved has been on a little holiday. It's come back from its holiday. It looks very refreshed and quite tanned. And so what that means is this slot has reappeared on the CMU podcast where I ask the Approver-in-Chief, Andy Malt,
hello,
to explain why he picked the tracks that he approved this week. It was a bank holiday on Monday, so it means we only have 3 approved tracks this week rather than 4, because, of course, these appear in the CMU Daily each day. So let's quickly run through the 3 that you have approved since the column returned. And on a Tuesday, it was the output of a project that we actually reported on a week earlier when it was sort of beginning,
yeah,
because it was a very quick speedy project, which was Variables. Remind us about this project.
So this is a project by experimental label Bigo and Twigetti, where they basically got together 8 musicians who over the course of a week created a collaborative album, but they didn't collaborate together. They all started at the beginning of the week, each person created their own track, and then they passed it on to the next one, and then the tracks were gradually passed on until each of the 8 musicians had kind of taken the work that had gone before them on each track and remixed it and reworked it until it was a complete album where everyone had worked on all 8 tracks on it. And it sort of, I don't know, it's almost like music by Chinese whispers. And it's very good. The results are good.
There is a game, isn't there, that you play at primary school where people do that either with pictures or with stories.
Yeah.
Where it gets passed along to the next person in the line and they have to continue it. But I suppose it's unusual to do that with music. Although they did do a little tester earlier in the year, didn't they, where they created an EP. But this was bigger version of the project.
They did an EP over 48 hours with 3 artists. This is, yeah, an album over a week with 8 artists. Jim Perkins, who a recently approved composer himself, who actually worked on this album, but also runs the label, and the project was his idea. He said that, you know, they hope to do this again, maybe tweaking how things work slightly, and seeing how it works another time. I don't know whether they would go with more composers over a longer period of time. A week's quite a long time to ask people to commit to. But it's interesting results, and I really like the finished album. Go and check it out.
Stream it and buy it. Next approvee, So Below.
So Below, I can't tell you a lot about So Below. She or they, I think she, is a new artist from New Zealand. That's really all the information there is. Some digging throws up, I think, some possible links to other New Zealand artists like Taste NASA, Space Above, and The Naked and Famous. But really, it's all about the music. So it's a really dark, kind of very tightly produced pop track that I have discovered bears to repeated listening quite well.
So just one track so far, although
just
there's an album in the pipeline?
No, I don't know. I can't tell you anything else. That's all I know.
Right.
I told you everything I know.
Well, let's assume there's an album in the pipeline. There usually is.
Yeah.
And the final approved artist this week is Jeffrey Lewis.
Jeffrey Lewis! Everyone loves Jeffrey Lewis. He's got a new album coming out in October called Manhattan, which is, I think, let's say a loose concept album inspired by New York. The first track from it is called Out of Town, which, if you aren't familiar with Jeffrey Lewis, is quite a good place to start because it shows off his lyrical skills of taking a fairly innocuous idea that you probably wouldn't really give much thought to normally and then turning it into some grand observation. In this case, he's singing about how boring life is when your partner goes away for a little while. And it's very good.
So go check that out. Go check them all out. CompleteMusicUpdate.com/approved. Read more and stream, listen, play. Hey, even buy some of the music. More approved next week.
So a juicy Beatles-related lawsuit now. A company in Canada called Stargrove Entertainment is suing Sony ATV and Universal Music, claiming that the major labels exploited their market dominance in order to stop its legitimate business from getting off the ground. And this is all to do with the extension to the copyright term on recordings.
It is indeed. This is a copyright terms lawsuit. The legitimate business of Stargrove Entertainment, which they are claiming Sony and Universal are attempting to hinder, is basically they're one of those companies that takes recordings that are out of copyright. So they are public domain, as copyright lawyers would say. Copyright doesn't last forever. Copyright always runs out eventually. Although the thing to remember in the music industry is there's two sets of copyright. There's the copyright in songs and there's the copyright in recordings. The copyright in songs generally lasts longer. So if the copyright in lyrics and musical score are nearly always locked these days to the people who write the songs. So it's normally the life of the songwriter and then a number of years. So in Europe, for songs, it's the life of the creator and then another 70 years. So that's quite a long time. Whereas with recordings, the copyright is normally linked to when the recording comes out rather than the lives of anybody involved in making the recording. So in Europe, it's 70 years. In the US, it's 95 years after release. And in Canada, it is as of now, as of June, in fact, also 70 years. So just like Europe, until very recently, though, it was 50 years. And what companies like Stargrove do is they find recordings that are out of copyright and then they release them, because once a recording is out of copyright, you no longer need to go to the original label or the original artist for permission. You can just use those recordings, stick them on CDs and sell them. And whenever you go in a filling station or a garden centre, for some reason, often seems to have a rack of sort of, you know, music from the early part of 20th century or maybe some 1950s rock and roll. And they seem to be really, really cheap. And that's because those recordings are out of copyright. So the label doesn't have to pay any of the original people involved in making the recordings. They just ram them on the CD. They make a nice little bit of packaging. They do, of course, have to pay royalties to the people who own the copyright in the songs, assuming the songs are still in copyright, which they probably are. So it's not that they don't have to pay any royalties at all, although in the record industry, normally the publishers and the songwriters are receiving less than 10% of the overall share of the pie. So there's still quite a lot of money for companies like Stargrove to grab.
Yeah, and where the Beatles come into this is, I mean, I don't know if we ever got, if this ever made the podcast, but I'm sure we discussed the campaign for copyright extension in Europe, which was successful, and the copyright on recordings went from 50 to 70 years in Europe in early 2013, by which time the Beatles' first single, Love Me Do, had gone out of copyright. So, and this wasn't applied retrospectively, so That single and its B-side are public domain now. You can all go and sell them on CD anywhere you want once you've got the publishing mechanical license to do that.
Anywhere you want in Europe, we should add, because of course, yes, as I said, in the US, it is a 95-year term and has been for quite a long time.
Yes.
So the whole Beatles oeuvre remains in copyright in the US, but you're right, that one track came out of copyright in Europe. But crucially, the term extension, and for the UK record industry, 2013 was a big deadline for getting the term increased from the 50 years to the 70 years, because 1962 is when the first Beatles single came out, 1963 is when the first Beatles album came out, and we sometimes forget the Beatles were an incredibly prolific band in the first few years of their career. So had they not got the term extension in Europe each year, because what happens is it's not exactly 70 years after release, it's on the 1st of January, the year after the 70 years have expired, or the 50 years as was.
Yes.
And so what would have happened had we not had term extension is every 1st of January, a bunch of Beatles recordings would have come out of copyright, and then the Rolling Stones would have started to come out of copyright. and those really big 60s British recordings, which the British record industry still makes a lot of money from, and in many cases it's Universal now that is making that money, having acquired certainly the Beatles catalogue, they would start losing that really important revenue stream. So that's why the record industry in Europe, and especially in the UK, lobbied so hard. They just about got it in time. They just lost those two tracks.
Yeah.
Over in Canada, however, as we mentioned, until June this year, it was still a 50-year term. So, for the last 2 years, Beatles albums have been coming out of copyright over there.
Yes, which means that their first, as you said, they were very prolific in that time, their first three albums are out of copyright in Canada, which is what Stargrove intended to sell. And not just in the garden centres, Stargrove had done a deal with Walmart to sell bundles of those three albums at a cheap price, and was able to do that because, like in Europe, the copyright extension was not applied retrospectively. So once those albums were out of copyright, they're out of copyright. They remain public domain. And so all Stargrove needed was the mechanical license to copy those onto CD and ship them out to Walmart stores. And they got the license. The Canadian Music Reproduction Rights Agency provided it quite happily. The CDs were pressed. They went into Walmart stores. And then people started buying them. And Sony ATV got a bit annoyed and revoked that license, which it is within its rights to do because there is no compulsory licensing system in Canada. Although this is the sticking point.
Yeah, and this is Sony ATV's business because they still control the vast majority of the Lennon-McCartney catalogue. So it is their copyrights that are being exploited here. And as you say, there's no compulsory license in Canada. So in the US, for example, when it comes to the mechanical copying of songs, so when labels press CDs with songs on them, there is a compulsory license. So the publisher is obliged to license, and it's all done through a sort of a set system that's put in place to statutory rates. However, in most other countries, there isn't actually a compulsory license. However, there is the collective licensing system. So that you mentioned it had a long name, didn't it? The Canadian Musical Reproduction Rights Agency, which, for people listening to this in the UK, is basically the Canadian version of MCPS. And if you are pressing CDs here in the UK, you will know you get a license to cover the copyright in the songs through the collective licensing system. You just go to MCPS, you fill out a standard form, you pay standard rates. It all just goes through the system. Often the publisher doesn't even know you've done that before the CD's on the market. And it almost works as if there was a compulsory license, even though technically there isn't. And publishers can at any point say, actually, I don't want you pressing copies of my song. And so it's interesting that this company, Stargrove Entertainment, has now gone legal on this in Canada. Although we're describing this as a copyright case, and it is a copyright case, they're actually taking them to the competition tribunal because they're not outright saying that Sony ATV have violated copyright law, because actually they haven't. They are within their rights to say, no, you can't license it. Yes, there may be a collective licensing system. Yes, the collective licensing system may have given you a license, but under copyright law, we're not obliged to license. We have the right to take that back and stop you distributing. So they can't fight them under copyright law, but they are trying to fight them under competition law on a number of sort of different arguments.
So for one thing, they imply that Sony ATV, or Sony and Universal, have a sort of gentleman's agreement to stop other people making use of their public domain recordings.
Yeah, because although Sony ATV itself or its sister company Sony Music don't really have any interest in the actual Beatles recordings, so why do they care? Having said that, Sony Music is sitting on its own public domain recordings that they would rather not get distributed by these companies like Stargrove. So I think there's no specific allegations that there has been any actual collusion on this specific case between Sony and Universal. But I think the allegation that Stargrave are trying to make is that the major record companies have these sort of informal agreements that they won't take each other's public domain recordings and try and monetize them, and that they will try and sort of run the business in a way to stop people from exploiting the really valuable public domain material.
Yeah, and so then that would be a competition issue, because they would essentially be artificially extending the copyrights on those recordings.
And there may well be some collective licensing regulation in this as well, in that over here in the UK, although technically there isn't a compulsory license covering mechanical copies when you're pressing CDs, it's all done for the collective licensing system. And the general principle is with collective licensing is everything's in and you can license anything, and there aren't too many case-by-case exceptions. And I think if publishers start to say, oh, everything is on the blanket license, oh, except this, except this, except this, then you might find licensees come forward and say, well, hang on a second, that's not the way collective licensing is meant to work. And competition law has lots of opinions about collective licensing, because competition law sees collective licensing as sort of being the music industry operating as a monopoly. And so there are special rules to cover how we license collectively. So there might be an argument that, that collective licensing rules under Canadian law should stop publishers from just taking out a few songs here and there to help other major players in the business. Either you're in or you're out. So they're sort of testing some quite ambiguous areas of law, although there are some more specific allegations about Universal trying to meddle.
Yes, they accuse Universal of putting pressure on a distributor not to distribute these CDs, and a member of staff there putting a review up saying that the CDs were of poor quality.
So it will be interesting to see when this gets to tribunal as to what debates are put forward, how Sony and Universal. There's also a couple of other smaller publishers who have some stake in some of those Beatles songs who are also listed as defendants, as is the mechanical rights body itself. So it'll be interesting to see if how they defend themselves and whether or not this opens up any sort of wider debate on the ways these... Because generally it is small little companies who spot those little valuable tracks that are now public domain, because copyright has been extended now in the whole of North America and in Europe. So these, you know, any Beatles tracks released 1965 onwards will not be coming public domain for another 20 years at least. Then sort of the really lucrative late 60s recordings are not going to be part of this for the foreseeable future. But there are still plenty of tracks in the 50s and the early 60s, and even more in Canada because extension happened that little bit later. And so it will be interesting to see if this tests the rules, albeit just in Canada, on what you can and can't do with those public domain recordings, and what the mainstream music industry can and cannot do to try and stop those really valuable recordings from being exploited by little startups and independents who didn't put any money in to creating the recordings back in the day. So, I think a very interesting case to keep an eye on.
Just quickly, time to look through a few other stories in brief that we didn't have time to talk about in at length this week. Going back to our discussion last week, Tyler, the Creator, has said that the UK government is treating him like a terrorist, which you might think was over the top, but it did actually turn out that the means through which they blocked him from entering the country last month were rules set up to stop terrorists getting into the country. So he's right.
Yeah, so interesting interview in The Guardian, I think, with Tyler, the Creator, on him being banned from performing in the UK for the next 3 to 5 years based on lyrics he wrote 5, 6 years ago. He said most of the things that we said last week, so I don't think we need to go across this in any more detail, although it is worth tracking down that article and giving it a read.
Yes. The US government, also going back to last week, does not care what happens to the data held on those mega upload servers that are sitting in a warehouse doing nothing at the moment. It's got all the evidence it needs, so that's enough.
Yeah, so last week we discussed at length about the lost mega upload data, and in particular that the lawyers representing Kim.com and the other mega upload founders had said that the American government should buy and store all of the servers that still have old mega upload data on it, because of this company Carpathia Hosting is having to pay to store those old servers and it doesn't want to anymore. But the US government said, we don't care what happens to those servers, they can be wiped for all we care, we've got all the evidence we need. You know, screw you mega upload trying to gather more evidence for your defense, screw you former mega upload customers who still have files on that, we don't care, you know, it's not our responsibility. So there you go, that was a predictable if disappointing response from the American authorities.
Another story we have discussed at length before on the podcast is that whole pre-1972 thing in the US. There's been an interesting lawsuit on that this week.
There has. We won't mention it greatly because we don't have time, and I'm sure we'll be coming back to it in coming weeks. But you might remember that Sirius, which is the satellite radio service, was sued by former members of a 60s band, The Turtles, who said that they needed to pay royalties for their 1960s repertoire, where because of some whims in American copyright law, Sirius and later Pandora were saying, we don't need to pay sound recording royalties on pre-1972 repertoire. A court in California and subsequently in New York said, actually, you do. And because of the sort of peculiarities of this case, A logical conclusion of what happened in the Californian court when the Turtles sued Sirius is that AM and FM radio stations in California should probably be paying royalties on pre-1972 sound recordings, which they have never done. And so what we saw this week was a little catalogue label in America putting that to the test and suing the three big broadcasters, including iHeartRadio, or iHeartMedia, I should say, in America, to test this, whether or not actually FM radio stations and AM radio stations should be paying record companies and artists royalties for pre-1972 repertoire. So an interesting development, if it gets to court, will be very interesting to see what happens.
Sticking with radio, XFM in the UK is going to relaunch as Radio X imminently, we are told, which will see it shift more into sort of absolute territory away from alternative music furrow it has ploughed for so many years. New presenters coming in are apparently going to be Chris Moyles, Vernon Kay, Johnny Vaughan and Ricky Wilson off of the Kaiser Chiefs. Still can't believe Ricky Wilson is a successful presenter type person.
These are rumours that have been doing the rounds for a long time now, since earlier this year, but everyone seems certain that an announcement is coming from XFM owners Global Radio sometime this month about its new direction and those new presenters. So it will be interesting to see what happens there and whether they manage to utterly screw up what was once a great radio station. We'll see.
We will see. Vine! You remember Vine? 6 seconds of looping video. It's adding some music stuff to its app. A thing called Snap to the Beat, which will help you trim loops of music so that they fit properly in the track. Interestingly, a featured tracks tab, which will provide you with a library of tracks you can use in your videos.
Yeah, and what's interesting about this development is there's been a lot of talk in recent months about people sampling bits of music to go on videos within things like Vine and Instagram and all the various messaging apps. And that has posed all sorts of questions as well. Who's licensing those little snippets of music? What sort of license is needed? And as far as we're aware, what Vine are saying is that with this little featured tracks tab, they will be sorting out the licensing. They will get licenses from labels and publishers and whoever they need licenses from, so that Vine users can legitimately use those little bits of music in their videos. Although they did then immediately start talking about the promotional value for artists in appearing in these Vine videos, which sort of makes it sound like their sell to the labels and publishers is going to be promo value. So we'll see how much money there actually is for the music industry out of this, but interesting development, and interesting because they were definitely talking about getting this properly licensed and having it legit.
Last on our list, Ian Rogers, who has worked at Yahoo Music, Topspin, Beats Music, and more recently Apple after Beats Music was obviously bought and turned into Apple Music, is leaving not only Apple, but the entire music industry.
Yes, we first heard about this development through the Financial Times last week. It is a little bit surprising because obviously Apple Music has only just launched. And he was particularly involved in the Beats One bit of the operation, which has probably been the most hyped bit of Apple Music. And as far as we're aware, Beats 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 are all due to arrive at some point in the future. So it does seem perhaps a little bit premature for him to be stepping down. And certainly people who work at Apple Music seem to be as surprised as anyone. But he issued a statement, I think, to the New York Times explaining that he just decided that this was sort of a landmark in both digital music's development and his career in music. It was time for a complete change. And as you say, not only is he leaving Apple, he's also leaving music, and he's going off to go and do digital stuff for a company that owns loads of sort of luxury brands, as they call them. LVMH is the name of the company.
Yes, and it owns things like Moët and Chandon and Christian Dior, Tag Heuer. Big fancy things. But this isn't just any exec leaving, you know, a big company. Ian Rogers is a very popular figure in digital music, and I think this was largely met with surprise. And I think people will be sad to see him go.
Yeah, and I suppose since he arrived at Apple, I mean, back when he was leading Topspin, he was an incredibly high-profile executive. We had him speaking at the Great Escape a few years ago, and he spoke at lots of events. He had his own sort of music business digital show on YouTube where he interviewed some really interesting people. Then people got excited when he went over to Beats to run their streaming service. Since the Apple acquisition, actually, he's had a much lower profile. Generally, all but the top execs at Apple don't have much of a public profile. He wasn't even particularly noticeable when Apple Music had its much-hyped launch. Nevertheless, because of his past work, I think people saw him as being a sort of a real champion for the music industry within Apple, and also somebody who truly understands both the music industry and the digital music sector. And so he was a friend to everybody at Apple Music. So I think it'll be a shame for Apple to lose him. But, well, fingers crossed he'll enjoy doing interesting digital things with all that champagne.
And finally, let's talk about how Kanye West is going to be president of the United States of America.
Now, I have to say, before we start talking about this, I personally have neither watched nor read his incredibly long and, I would imagine, slightly tedious acceptance speech when he won the Michael Jackson Video Vanguard Award, which apparently is a thing,
apparently,
at the MTV VMAs in the United States last week. So he got the sort of outstanding contribution prize, and he gave a very long speech, as you would expect. And, well, you've been reporting on this, so I'm assuming that you've dissected what he said and it and the ramifications.
Well, he said a lot of things. It was a 13-minute speech. There was a rumour that apparently he was supposed to be performing as well as giving a speech, but at the last minute decided he just wanted to use the entire slot to talk. And talk he did.
People who've been to his concerts will know that that is sometimes his performance.
Yeah.
So people were getting a sort of Kanye West concert experience by having him rambling nonsense for 13 minutes.
Yeah, so he said a lot of things. He talked quite a lot about how he didn't really understand award ceremonies and he thought it was wrong to put five people up for an award and then give it to one of them and say the rest are losers.
Especially if one of them is Beyoncé.
Especially if one of them is Beyoncé. He did sort of apologise for, it was at the VMAs a few years ago when he got on stage and stopped Taylor Swift's acceptance speech, instead insisting that Beyoncé should have won it. He's apologised for that before, but he apologised again on stage at the VMAs. He also noted that he had smoked something before going on stage, which means possibly you can take the conclusion of his speech with a pinch of salt, but he did say that he was planning to run for president in 2020.
Now, we have to remember that in the US at the moment, the Republicans and the Democrats are busy trying to decide who should stand for them in the next presidential election next year. So presidential stuff is very much headline news at the moment stateside. Although he wasn't putting his hat in for the forthcoming election, but the next one in 2020.
No, you've got to let Donald Trump win first.
Yes, because of course he's trying to be the Republican candidate. And having been a bit of a joke candidate at the start, it's sort of now worryingly looking like he could be a front runner. But there you go.
Yes, and various people have commented on this. Rihanna, for one, she said, if you know, people are voting for Donald Trump, why wouldn't you vote for Kanye?
Which is a fair point.
The White House's press secretary, Josh Earnest, said that he was looking forward to seeing what Kanye had written on his campaign hat, which I think is a reference to Donald Trump, who has a campaign hat because he's got to cover up his really terrible hair. And Donald Trump also, I think, has probably spoken most on this because Rolling Stone interviewed him about it, and he spoke for about 40 seconds, but he managed to get quite a lot into that 40 seconds, concluding saying that he hoped to run against him someday, which I think might be Donald Trump announcing that he is going to go for a second term in 2020 after winning the upcoming election and leading America into darkness.
So there you go. In some bizarre future, the 2020 US presidential election.
Imagine if that
Donald
was a
Trump
thing that happened.
Versus Kanye West. Well, it would be entertaining.
It would. Entertaining and slightly terrifying.
And if Donald Trump could teach Kanye how to get his statements down to 40 seconds, that would be a happy outcome.
It would, yeah. Donald Trump might win it on brevity.
But there you go.
So that's it. Donald Trump 2016, Kanye 2020. This is the future of America and the world.
God knows who could then stand in 2024 to follow on those two presidents. Maybe we would have could Justin Bieber even stand? He's Canadian, isn't he? So you see, I was going to suggest that Justin Bieber with his floppy new haircut could be 2024.
He would
but he's
be
not
denied.
American, so he couldn't be
denied on the Arnold Schwarzenegger technicality. Maybe Justin Bieber can run California. They seem to let anyone
maybe
do that.
Perhaps Taylor Swift and Beyoncé could be 2024. And then where would Kanye's loyalties lie? So these are all things that are going to happen in the future. In the former superpower state that is the United States of America. Anyway, I think that's all we've got time for on this edition of the CMU podcast.
It definitely is.
I think it was a very fine edition. I don't think anybody listening will have any recollection of what we talked about in the opening few minutes. So
I've reminded
done
them.
Us.
I'm no, looking forward to your interview just, next week. That's all I'm saying.
What, why don't you just insist that they share the podcast and then we can be done with it?
Yeah, share this podcast far and wide so that everyone knows that Chris Cook is going to interview some people in a bakery next week. Follow us on Twitter at CMU, Facebook, Complete Music Update. The CMU podcast is presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It's produced by Matt Peaty. And for more on CMU, visit CompleteMusicUpdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an unlimited production in association with 7 Digital.
That was quite long, wasn't it?
An hour and 5 minutes. Hopefully there's quite a lot to edit out.
I think that... Yes, there's quite a lot to edit out.